Really, when you get down to it, the goal of the mentor is to make somebody else successful and not demonstrate how successful you are.
Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Sam Adams, who is a paramedic over in Colorado in the US. Now Sam and Chris's brother wrote Life and Death Matters, which is an incredible book that I think every single person listening to this, or any person really in pre-hospital, should get their hands on. So today Sam and I are going to talk about mentorship. Now, mentorship is something that we don't necessarily get taught about a lot at university, and this isn't just necessarily you and your trainer or your clinical mentor on road if you're on placement. But this can also extend into a lot of those student volunteering roles that include mentorship. So starting to develop these things really early is really important, because when you get out on road and you are expected to mentor people, it's good to know all of these concepts. So we're going to talk about clinical decision making and mentorship together. So thanks for joining, Sam. If you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, hi, Alex. Yeah, so my name's Sam. I really appreciate you having us on the show, or having me on the show. So I'm a paramedic in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I work for the Colorado Springs Fire Department, and I've been a paramedic for about 11 years now, and I've been in EMS for 15. So that's a little bit about my background. I'm not much more than that, but I've done quite a bit of training with different students, all different walks of life, and tried to bring people about as much as we can to make them successful.
That's awesome. And so I guess what we're first going to talk about is that decision making, and as you mentioned off air, decision making and mentorship go hand in hand. So we'll start off with decision making. So what is clinical decision making? What are the principles of it? What does it comprise of?
Well, I think decision making really actually begins, there's like a four-step method that I train everybody in. And Chris and I go through this in depth in our paddle course, which is a new course that we had developed last year. And we've come up with the acronym ICPE, which is I-C-P-E. And so I think that decision-making really involves all four of these processes. And so I stands for information. So I think that when we get to a good decision-making process, we have to realize that information is kind of what drives good decisions. It's not necessarily experience. And I think in EMS specifically, experience is way overvalued as it relates to good decision making. And so experience can really help to inform our decision, but it doesn't really drive our decisions. And so if you have enough information, that's really the key. So, and case in point, I mean, if you run on a chest painter, and you need to, before you can call a cardiac alert, you need to have enough information as to whether or not it's a STEMI. So in order to do that, you have to do a 12 lead. You have to look, you have to interpret the 12 lead properly. You have to methodically go through that. And then you might have enough information to be able to call a STEMI, but you can't just, based on your experience, look at someone and say, you're having a STEMI. There's more information that needs to be gathered. So I think a good decision-making process starts with gathering information, and then really integrating that with your character of humility, and allowing that information to be objectively kind of digested so that you can move forward with your process.
That's awesome. So, yeah, I think you're so right in terms of that humility aspect of it. You know, where I guess you have that understanding that, you know, you don't know everything. and it gives you that sort of permission to, I guess, challenge that information you're gathering. Is that sort of what you're meaning around that humility side of things?
Yeah. Yeah. I think really what I'm getting at is that you hit the nail on the head. We don't know everything. And really, as paramedics, you know enough to know you don't know anything. We're not internal medicine doctors or ICU docs or ER docs or anything like that. So you know enough that you can recognize certain illnesses, certain signs and symptoms, and be able to react and create certain treatment plans for them. But your experience alone isn't going to cut it. And if you're not humble enough to allow the information to be objectively kind of digested, then you're going to make bad decisions.
Absolutely. And I think that realization particularly comes, I don't know, as other students, but I think that realization for me came through in that second year of university. After you go on that first placement, you know, you come off on this high, you're like, yes, I've, you know, been out on road now, I've had that experience, and you think you know everything you sort of need to know for a moment, and then you go back to uni and they bombard you with a lot more information and you go, wow, there is a lot more to go. Like, and you talk to all these incredible people who have been in the service for 10 plus, 20 plus years, and they still explain the fact that they make mistakes and they don't know necessarily what's going on with a patient. I think that role modeling of humility, showing that, yeah, we don't know everything, is really, really cool and really critical for, I guess, making that decision making a bit better. So I guess then you've said, you know, you integrate it with character. So how can we, I guess, improve decision making as a student? How can we sort of start to develop that quite early on in our degrees and in our practice?
Well, I think one of the first things you do, at least that I do regularly, is take a step back and not insert myself into a situation that may not require it. And so what I really think is important is, as like the mentor, you need to step back and see where your student actually is and what they actually need help with, because they may not need help with decision making. They may not need help with certain aspects of their practice. So I think that you allow them some latitude to work for a couple calls. And I don't know exactly what kind of system you guys run, but I would imagine you run on, you know, your equivalent to a 911 alarm, and allowing that student to kind of take that call and run with it and see where they go. And then obviously intercede if you need to, but don't be too quick to jump the gun on whether or not you need to help. Because if you can't identify what the problem is or what the student needs help with, you're not going to be able to help them. And to assume certain things, and to assume that the student needs help in one area or the other is a waste of your time and it's a waste of their time. So you need to identify what they're struggling with first. And then you can try to help build that decision-making process for them.
Yeah, for sure. So you've jumped into that sort of mentoring side of it, backing off of decision-making. So just to sort of rewind a little bit there, how does developing your own clinical decision-making relate to mentorship?
You have to be extremely patient with people. You have to be, generous and kind with them and really forgiving, and realize that even after your training is done, they're not going to necessarily be at the level that you're at now. And you need to just bring them up to the speed that is required of them so that they're proficient enough to act independently, and be forgiving enough to recognize that they're not going to be where you are. And so I think the biggest thing is to try to develop a system that creates confidence. And so Chris and I have developed a system that we call the confidence wheel. And really it starts with self-discipline. and instilling a sense of self-discipline within your student and then reinforcing that. And then we go through a number of different stages. And in my experience, every single student goes through all the same stages. And at the end of it, they can become much more confident. But only a mentor that is really having an attitude of service towards their student is going to be able to make that student successful, especially if it's a difficult student. I think that really, when you get down to it, the goal of the mentor is to make somebody else successful and not demonstrate how successful you are. That's really the key to being a good mentor. I think that that's probably a pretty big problem in EMS in general, all over the world. People are more interested in demonstrating their own capability rather than pursuing somebody else's success and trying to make somebody else successful.
That's pretty powerful. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, that act of service, I guess that's part of the reason why I guess a lot of people become a paramedic, you know, and they think of it as an act of service to their community or to the patients they're caring for. But I really love that act of service towards growing other people and developing other people's learning. So you did mention just there the wheel of confidence. So what you said, there were the steps, and you said the first step was self-discipline. What are the other steps of that?
Yeah, so in my experience, all these students go through a series of steps, and it always begins with self-discipline, and that's going to lead to developing an understanding of intention. And what we mean by intention is, what are they, what is the intention of why you're a paramedic, and what is the intention of the patient that's in front of you? What are you intending to do? And what really drives that is your preparation and a proper application of the work that you've put in already. So we're talking about going to medic school or going to nursing school and trying to create getting the baseline information so that you can start to create good decisions. And so, are you going to school with the intention of actually having to use that information? Are you going out on the alarm that you get called to? Are you going out to the alarm with the actual intention of helping whoever it is that is out there? Or are you just kind of sitting back and putting it on autopilot? And so I think that with that intention and proper preparation, then you have to drive home the point that they have to be consistent. And so consistency really is a byproduct of going out the door with intent, with the intention of helping. And so if you do that consistently and you are properly assessing your patients in a consistent and methodical way, something that Chris and I really, really harp on is the methodical approach. And so you have to go through and assess each patient and do the proper line of questioning methodically and do that consistently with every single patient. And so the byproduct of consistency is reliability. So once you start to recognize and you start to do things consistently, like we'll just take the example of listening to lung sounds. So you're disciplined in learning what the lung sounds mean. Then you go out with the intention of actually having to listen to lung sounds. Then you consistently start listening to people's lungs, whether they're have clear and equal breaths or they're wheezing or they're ronchi or their rails or whatever it is. Now you start to listen to these things consistently, and now you're able to pick up, oh, that's wheezing, that's wheezing, that's wheezing. And so now you're consistently able to recognize that, and that creates reliability. So now you trust what it is that you're, what you're listening to, and you know, oh, that is wheezing. I need to do X, Y, and Z for the patient that has COPD and is wheezing. And so then after you do that for some time, that reliability turns into, it develops a habit. And so now you're not so worried about some of the smaller aspects of what you're actually listening to. You recognize quicker what the wheezing actually is, develops that habit, and then you're able to actually perform the last the last stage, with this, which is execute. And so sometimes this wheel can go, can take quite a long time to develop, but within the first probably 5 or 6 months of the candidate, they should easily be through the reliability stage. That's really where they're at. And then they're going to develop the habits on their own. But if you can instill that sense of self-discipline, instill the sense of proper preparation and the intention of actually using what you've learned and then implementing those things consistently, whether you're on, it doesn't matter what type of patient you're on, but implementing all those things consistently, you recognize that it's reliable. So now you're able to trust what you're looking at, trust your interpretation of everything, trust the patient that you're looking at. You're able to trust the vital signs that you've acquired. And now you're able to develop this habit, and then you're able to just start executing treatment plans pretty quickly. And that creates a huge degree of confidence. And so with the idea of self-discipline being a start, and for the mentor, really the million-dollar question that I've come up with is, it's easy to say, okay, self-discipline, but how do you instill self-discipline? How do you create self-discipline within a student? And that's really the hard part. And so the whole confidence wheel, Chris and I really came up with that ourselves, but then we needed to go a step further and say, well, it's easy to say you start with self-discipline, but what if somebody isn't disciplined? How do you create that? And so it's actually really simple. You create it with structure. You build structure. And so you create a situation that they have to work within, whether it's you get to the station each day and this is what you're going to do. These are your checkoffs. You have to do all these things every day. And then with each patient, you have to do this, 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 and this. And you start to develop this structure and then force them to adhere to that and get them to buy in on the structure you're creating. And then that will develop the discipline that will lead to all the other stages. And in my experience, every single student that I've trained has gone through every single one of those stages. And if you set it up in that kind of context, they'll come out really successful.
That's awesome. There are so many points that we can unpack in there. And in particular, I love the overall sort of theme of having that systematic approach to things, that methodical approach. And it's something that, you know, is harped on about by, you know, every single person we speak to. And, you know, whether that be when you're doing that clinical assessment or whether, you're doing a systematic approach for, checking your truck every day or whatever it may be. But it always seems like in paramedicine or in pre-hospital environment that everything is systematic. So I really love that point. The second point of that too was that application of knowledge and I guess that intention behind it, because something we talk about quite a lot is not studying for just a test, studying for life or death. And I think that's something that we can kind of get swayed a little bit with as students. We think we have to know so much information about everything. But then if we don't actually apply it, then what's the point? So I really like that part of it. And so I guess that system or the wheel you just talked about there, does that apply also to just yourself? And as you said, you know, we need to develop our own decision-making so that we can be a good mentor and actually implement this wheel for our students in the future.
I know that I use that for sure. And those are the stages that I've gone through. And I think that is probably a universal truth, that those are the stages you go through, despite whatever discipline it is, whether you're playing the guitar or running 911 calls. Because you start doing the things consistently, you realize that it's reliable, you start building those habits. But I think that it's a little bit different than just decision making. That builds someone's confidence, but the decision making is really embedded within that. And so the decision making would really be between like the consistency and reliability stages, where you reinforce what a decision is and how to properly interpret what you're looking at. And so what what we've come up with and what I teach every single student of mine is the acronym ICBE, like I alluded to before. And so you gather that information and then you have to categorize it. You have to categorize the information you're looking at. Is this a trauma patient? Is it a respiratory patient? Is it a cardiac patient? Is it a multi-casualty incident? What kind of 911 call are we on? What is the patient in front of me? And then after you categorize it properly, you have to prioritize. You have to prioritize, if it's an MCI, you have to prioritize your patients. If it's not, you have to prioritize your treatment plans. So do you want to get lung sounds before you do a 12 lead on a respiratory patient? Do you want to do an IV before you listen to lung sounds? Do you want to do vital signs before you do an IV? All these different things you start prioritizing. And you require the student to think about how are they prioritizing the interventions that they are, that they're asking for the team to do, or that they're doing themselves. And I think that's really important. And what I've found is that when you start talking about prioritizing interventions, it really gets the student to start to think about what it is they're actually doing. And it requires them to understand more appropriately what they're doing and why. And so, because then they're not just spouting off, hey, give me a 12 lead, give me an IV, give me a whatever. And so I think that and then after you prioritize all those things, then you can just start executing. So information, categorize it, prioritize it, and then execute. And so that's really the stages that you want to use for decision making. And I've taught that to a lot of different people, and it seems to be really successful. They react pretty well to it because it's something they can actually digest. It's not just, hey, make a good decision. Well, yeah, but what does that mean? And how do you do that? You know? And so it breaks down how to actually make a good decision or at least make a decision on something. And then implementing that consistently, they'll realize it's reliable, and then they'll just be off to the races.
That's awesome. So going from that point, then, you know, you've executed that. So you've gone through ICPE. So you've executed it. So then you've realized now that it's reliable, but you have to go through, I guess, that process of reflection to find out, you know, was what you were doing was correct, and, you know, did it work out for you in the end? So where does reflection slot into this? And, you know, I read in your book the difference between self-reflection and general reflection. If you could just speak upon a bit about that, if that's cool with you.
Yeah. So I think you bring up a great point. It's reflection is extremely important. And I think reflection is an ongoing process for your entire career. At least it should be. And so at any point during the entire process, reflection should be taking place. And sometimes that can be led by the instructor or the mentor, and kind of what that looks like in the mentor and the instructor kind of relationship is you're sitting down after the call and you're just asking them, hey, what happened? What were you looking at? Why did you want to do this? What were you thinking? You know, and it's not ever really in an accusatory manner, because if you're doing things in an accusatory manner, then they're going to be automatically on the defensive. So open up those lines of communication so that they can trust you. And the reality is that if the call got out of hand, it's not the student's fault. It's your fault that it got out of hand, and you should have intervened before it got out of hand. And so now if you're grilling the student on something, that was really your fault, they're going to be super defensive. And so you've got to reflect in an appropriate manner and just ask a lot of questions and require them to go through it and think through, well, this is what I saw, this is why I wanted to do that. And then you're able to reinforce, you know, your thoughts on that based on your understanding and experience and based on what you were looking at, and say, yeah, that's a good idea. That's why you want to listen to lung sounds and all these different, you know, whatever it is. And so reflection is super important. Super important. It's an ongoing process.
That's awesome. So, reflection is something that is brought up by pretty much most people we speak to, as part of a really important way of, you know, ensuring that one, you're reflecting on how you went well in the case, and then obviously how you reacted to it, and then, you know, why you do certain things. So when we're talking about how to be the best mentor, as you said, you know, really having that active service to improving the learning of others and the growth of others, rather than trying to show off what you know, how can now, say, a student who is the mentee, you know, optimize that relationship and try and get the most out of that relationship that you have?
That's a really good question. And I think that probably in large measure, it's not really up to them, and it's up to you as the mentor. You as the mentor really, really have to create the environment that allows them to act freely and create that trusting environment. That's how they're going to get the most out of it. And so if they're not engaged, then that might be a different situation. But in most situations that we deal with pretty highly motivated people that want to be there. They're not going through medic school for grins. And so really the vast majority of people we're dealing with are wanting to be successful and get as much out of it as they can. And so if you as the mentor are creating that environment for them, then you will ultimately lead them to wanting them to be more successful. So it's difficult if the student is really hitting their head against the wall with the mentor, and they are the ones doing all the work, it's just not going to work out. It's going to be much more difficult, because they can recognize that the student or the instructor is not really invested in their success, and that creates a kind of a hostile situation.
And in that hostile situation, you know, most people have experienced, you know, a couple, maybe one, at least, mentors that it was quite difficult to navigate that relationship and trying to have an environment that is conducive to learning. So, you know, I think most people have experienced that either at university or on placement due to multiple factors, whether that be that mentors haven't actually been taught how to mentor, or maybe the conditions of the job or the day or whatever it may be. But when you are in that difficult relationship or that difficult environment, you know, you can be there for multiple weeks on end. How can you try and sort of, I guess, make that environment the best you can as a student to try and get the most out of it in that difficult situation where you're not getting a good mentor relationship?
Yeah, that's definitely a good question, because there's plenty of poor mentors out there that don't have any training, or they're not interested in it, or they're forced to do it because they've got enough experience, so to speak, to do that. So I think that if you're in that situation as a student, look at it as a positive and realize that whoever's in front of you, you can definitely learn something from. They're not going to take your birthday away from you, and you can try to assimilate as much as you can into their environment and into the team that they're in. And you can always try to learn something from them. And then sometimes you're going to have to really kind of fall back on that chain of command and just kind of do what you're told, do what you're asked to, try to fulfill the expectations. If you as the student are having difficulty with your mentor, the number one thing you have to do is go to them and ask them, what are your expectations of me? Okay. Those things need to be clearly laid out, whether or not, whether it doesn't matter what the expectations are, but if you, the student, don't understand how you're supposed to be operating or what your parameters are, and what your expectations are, you're never going to be as successful as you could if that talk had already happened. So the first thing that I would do if you're having trouble is go to your mentor and say, hey, I feel like I don't know exactly what is expected of me. Can you lay out what your expectation of me is? And if you need to, you can get as detailed as possible. What's your expectation of me being on the rig? What's your expectation of me at the station? What's your expectation of me on calls? And then you can start to create that relationship. And then you can understand when you as the student are going outside of what that expectation is. So if you're having difficulty, that's the first thing you need to do is establish what those expectations are.
That's really good. I really like that. And that's something that in particular in the last few placements I had after learning about that was to quite literally ask, because I'd have different mentors every few days, would ask, what is your expectation of me as a final year paramedic student, or what was your expectation of me as a second year nursing student? And I think that then, because everyone's different, everyone has different expectations, because everyone's, you know, as we've mentioned off air, you know, everyone was mentored differently. So everyone sort of does mentoring different. So yeah, I think that kind of, like you said, just puts you on the front foot a little bit more in that long placement you may have. And it sort of sets you up for success.
The other thing that does that's really important is it creates a relationship that requires accountability. And so it requires accountability on the mentors, in the mentor role, because you've now laid out what your expectations are. So now whether you have to hold yourself accountable to those things. And if that's not taking place, then that needs to be addressed. And then you as the student understand what the expectations are, and now you can hold yourself accountable. And now each person within that relationship are better able to hold each other accountable and then move forward towards a successful relationship and a successful internship. But really, I mean, honestly, the first thing that I do with every single student is set expectations. So they understand exactly where I'm coming from, what's required of them, how I want them to behave, how I want them to interact with patients. And then you can always alter that if you need to. So that's definitely the starting point, always.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think that's a really important point. And I love it too, because, I read in your book, you outlined the characteristics and the interpersonal characteristics you need to have in order to be a paramedic, and how that relates to decision making, and then thus now how that also interacts and relates to mentorship, and those being accountability and responsibility and ownership and professionalism. And I thought those are really fantastic points. So how do those 4 points, or accountability and ownership in particular, how do they integrate into your decision making, but then how do they also integrate into mentoring?
Well, that's a lot to unpack there. But
even
that's,
if it's a summary.
yeah. That's a good question. Really, what it really boils down to is that everything you do, whether it's in EMS or in life, boils down to integrity. And whether or not you conduct yourself with integrity. And so, and that means that you're holding yourself accountable to the standards that have been set forth in front of you, or that you've set forth for yourself. And accountability is extremely important in recognizing when you have strayed from where you're supposed to be, and bringing yourself back into proper alignment. And then that allows you to hold yourself accountable, but it also allows you to hold your student accountable for whether or not they're going outside the boundaries of the expectations that you've laid forth. And as far as decision making, I mean, one of my favorite quotes in the book, if not my favorite quote, is really that accountability equals liberty. If you're going to, all decisions are made with the understanding that you have to take accountability for what you're going to do. So one of the last criteria that I always look for in a student is whether or not they're going to be accountable for their actions. And I look for that when I'm about to release somebody for independent practice. That's one of the four criteria that I look for of whether or not they're capable of doing that. And if they're not, then we have to continue, or it needs to be properly addressed. But accountability equals liberty. If you're willing to take accountability for the decision you make, it frees you to be able to make that decision. Good, bad, or indifferent, it gives you the ability to actually act if you're going to take accountability for it. So I think that's kind of a quick summary, but yeah, accountability is super important. And that goes hand in hand with ownership, basically owning your actions, taking accountability and responsibility for what you've done.
That's awesome. And I think in particular, like, yeah, owning your mistakes and owning the decisions you'll make. But yeah, I think in particular, we've had a lot of people come on who have been, you know, emergency physicians, or they've been critical care paramedics, or, you know, in the job for quite some time, and they're still so willing to open up about mistakes that they've made in order to, one, I think, create an environment that is conducive to being able to own up to it and creating that accountability and environment. And I think that's awesome, so that you can actually have people role model that for you. And I think anyone can really do that, just being open about their mistakes. And I love that. It makes it easier to, you know, do your job if you're willing to be open about and take ownership for all your decisions you make. So
from a leadership perspective, that's extremely difficult, because you have to realize that if your student is not conducting themselves appropriately, it's not because they don't know what they're doing. It's because you have failed to properly give them the instruction on what they're supposed to be doing. You, as their leader, have failed to lay out what your expectations are, what your intention is, what your leader's intent is, and what the parameters are for them to be operating. Now, if they continue to do that after you've talked about that, that's a different issue. But you need to, at the get-go, you need to address it in a way that you take responsibility as their leader of what did I do to fail you? Why did you react that way? And this is the way we want to move going forward.
That's great. So I think, I guess what we've talked about there is that you did say, so you had the wheel of confidence. So you're trying to take all those steps to build confidence in your mentee, and then, you know, creating the environment of being accountable and taking ownership for decisions. So taking that sort of decisiveness round for your students as well. So I guess those are two really important parts of becoming or developing yourself as a paramedic or a clinician, and having also that, you know, expectations talk. So where it's a two-way street, asking one, what you expect, or telling your student what you expect of them, and then equally the student sort of expressing what their expectation is of a mentor. Is that something that you utilize, getting the student to sort of think about what their expectations are within that mentor-mentee relationship?
Yeah, that's extremely important. And usually that takes a few days. Usually the student doesn't understand exactly what they're expecting, because a lot of times they haven't thought about that. They're too busy putting their time in other things like studying, and getting some preparation before they begin their internship. And so a lot of times they haven't even thought about what they're expecting, or at least defined it so that they could tell you what they're expecting. So what I typically do is, after I talk with them about the expectations, I ask them what their expectations are of me, and then give them some time, give them a few days to kind of mull that over, and then come back to you and kind of address it. But it's super important, because you have to have that two-way street. And you, as the mentor, you're the one that has to open it. You have to open that street up. You can't require them to do it, because it'll never get opened. You're the one driving the bus. And so you have to point it in the direction you want. And if you want open communication with them, you have to be the one to do that. And the best way to do that is with an expectation stock.
That's really good. I really love that one. And I think it's something that should be done. Yeah, every placement, even at university with your mentors or your tutors, whatever it may be. I guess to finalize, I'd love to just pick your brain a bit about feedback and mentors providing feedback. You know, we've all had the experience where we've been provided feedback in that's not delivered in the best way. And I think you did allude to the fact within our chat here that as soon as you do it in a way that's, say, you're embarrassing the student or you're calling them out in an inappropriate way, you basically shut down their ability or their willingness to learn from you. So what is the best way to provide feedback?
Well, I think there's two things to think about is what type of feedback are you going to provide? Is it going to be positive or negative? Both of which are valuable and both of which are important and serve their purpose. But if you're going to be providing negative feedback, it's super important to try to not try to, you have to do that in private. Okay. You can't start chastising people in public because then they're going to become even more defensive and the pack of wolves just start to come in on them. And then it's not just you, it's everybody else has to chime in and this and that. That's just not what is needed. And so, but you have to do so in kind of a forgiving manner, not attacking the student or being accusatory, and create it so that it's more of a learning, like of what they did incorrectly and how they can move forward in a more appropriate way. If you have negative feedback without solutions, you're not doing anybody any good. And so you have to have the solution in place or have at least thought about what the solution is before you just go at them. And so, because they have to have a way out of how to better themselves. So those, obviously feedback is way important, but the other thing that feedback with, in my experience anyway, that's important is feedback is for your student. Feedback is not for you as the mentor to demonstrate how great you are at something. And so I think that that tends to be kind of the fallback. And somebody will say, you know, this one time I ran this shooting and this is what I did. It's like, nobody cares. Nobody cares about the shooting that you ran 2 years ago that doesn't have any application towards what's going on right now with your student. All it does to your student is reinforces that you're not interested in their success and you are interested in your own capability. And so it creates a bad relationship with your student. So when you're giving feedback, don't give stories. That's not the time for stories. I can think of four separate stories that I tell during my internship, and those are for very specific reasons. And that's about all I go for because it's just not needed. And I wait for those things to come up before we even start discussing it. And those are all failures on my part and what I learned about it. And so feedback is super important. Do it in the appropriate way. If you're giving negative feedback, do it in private. Be forgiving and humble and allow your student to talk about what happened themselves and voice their concerns. And if you've created a good environment, these things will take place naturally. They'll take place naturally because they'll be disappointed they let you down. If you've created a good environment, they will be disappointed that they let you down. And then you chalk it up and move forward.
I think that's a perfect way to deliver feedback. Really, really love that. And I love the fact that you said the stories you have shared are the ones that you usually have made a mistake and you're trying to share that. And I think that just provides such a vulnerability and that connectedness between, say, you and your student or you and your mentor, just so that you're able to recognize or tell them that, you know, be humble about it and be like, yep, we all make mistakes. We don't know everything and you can get better at it. It's quite hopeful. But the last thing I just wanted to end on was just because you've mentioned it a few times in terms of providing sort of a really an environment that's, you know, compassionate, got humility, and really about service. And the one quote I just wanted to mention that I absolutely love out of your book, and it's like that I've referred to so many times now, is around the fact, and this relates to you as a mentor, mentoring students, and then equally how you treat patients, is that you don't have any more intrinsic value than anybody else. And I love that quote that you say in the book, and it's just something that's really stuck with me. That one quote's really stuck with me, and I think that's just, it emulates everything that you need to be as a paramedic.
Yeah, that that quote is actually from a pastor of mine growing up, and that's what he would say. And I think it really is important that we understand that we as people, not just paramedics, but people in general, you're not more intrinsically valuable than somebody else just because of who you are, or the color of your skin, or where you came from, or what language you speak. You're not intrinsically more valuable than anybody else. And so I think as a medic, it's super important to remember that. And if you can conduct yourself with that type of attitude, it really will help create or help reduce burnout, in my experience. And so, because you actually now are adopting an attitude of service. And if you can do that with your student specifically and be there for them and realize you're not better than your student, you're more qualified, you may have more experience, you may have more understanding, you know, more training, but you're not better than they are intrinsically. So take all those different things and serve your student and help develop them.
That's amazing. I love that. And I think it's a perfect way to end our conversation today. And I can't thank you enough for coming on. I really appreciate it, and for you sharing your knowledge. And I'll just get you to sort of say where our students and listeners can find a bit more about your work with Chris in terms of the books and your courses.
Yeah, so you can find us pretty easily. You can find both of our books on Amazon. And the first book is Life and Death Matters, and the second book is The Field Medic's Workbook. If you can go on Amazon and find both of those. You can go to our website. Our website is www.field-medics.com, and you can find us there and find information on how to get the book. And if you're interested in taking our course, which is PADL, stands for Paramedic Assessment, Development, and Leadership. If you're interested in taking that, it's about a 7-hour course, and it's broken up into a bunch of different segments. So it's not, you're not sitting there for 7 hours. It's way broken up. That can be found at paddlecourse.com, PADLcourse.com. And then you can find us on Instagram at Field Medics. And so those are really the best places to get in contact with us, especially Instagram.
That's amazing. Thank you for that. And just to finalize for all of everyone who is listening, we did talk about mentoring and mentorship. And whilst a lot of people think that that occurs when you're qualified and out on road, it does, but it equally means like a lot of students do a lot of student peer facilitating and mentoring. So it's important to start learning all of these now. So thank you so much, Sam. I really appreciate it. And I hope everyone really enjoyed that. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.